How is confessional Lutheranism similar to and different from American evangelicalism, Roman Catholicism, and Eastern Orthodoxy? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May is titled Being Lutheran. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040, 800-325-3040. Save $2 by ordering Being Lutheran during the month of May. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month, Being Lutheran. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Maybe you're one of those prospective voters. You're not even sure you want to be a voter this year around. You're disillusioned by what's been going on, not only in Washington, D.C., but those who aspire to enter the highest office there in Washington, D.C., the White House. You're disillusioned by that as well. And you're disillusioned by the fact that you have been a dutiful citizen trying to defend life and natural marriage and family. You've written your letters to your congressmen. You stay in touch with them. And you try and engage in the public square as much as you can. And you got to ask at this point, what has it gotten you? We're going to get a Washington update with Tim Gagelein here for the next half hour of Issues Etc. on this Thursday afternoon, May the 26th. Tim is a regular guest. He's vice president for external relations for Focus on the Family. Formerly served as a special assistant to President George W. Bush and as a deputy director for the White House Office of Public Liaison. He's author of the book, The Man in the Middle, an inside account of faith and politics in the George W. Bush era. Tim, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Todd, it's great to be with you again. Thanks.
What do you say to our listeners? Not all of them, but there are certainly some of them who are just disillusioned right now. They've spent their adult lives fighting politically for pro-life candidates, for pro-family candidates. They've written their congressmen. They voted. They've gotten out and done that work. They're disillusioned now, and they think that, well, frankly, the system is broken, and the people who represent them are corrupt and have bought into a corrupt system. What do you say to them?
Well, I say two things. First, you know, St. Augustine, in his time, actually faced, relatively speaking, many of the same broadly felt issues, that culture was going in the wrong direction, that the political climate was going in the wrong direction. And he famously wrote that discouragement and despair is a sin. And he said that discouragement and despair is a sin because it negates the hope of Jesus Christ. Now, it's absolutely true. Augustine famously believed, wrote, said that we are simultaneously, as Christians, citizens of two places. You know, this earth, the country where God has placed us, but we are also citizens who are, you know, heaven bound. And so he said, you know, that you feel that sense of homesickness, and you're uncertain why. I think C.S. Lewis, many years later, you know, echoed the same view, and it's because, you know, you're not quite at home on earth as a Christian, and that's really true. And I say this, Todd, because I think so many of us who are Christians, we want to invest a great sense of both practicality and idealism in this remarkable country where God has placed us. And so we say, I don't understand. I advocate the right viewpoint for my worldview. I write letters and I send emails and I send texts and I'm in touch with the people, you know, whom I voted for. And even if I didn't vote for them, I'm in touch. And I'm sharing, you know, my views with my own concentric circle of influence. Why does it all seem to be going the wrong way? And so, you know, my view, and it's fairly strongly held, is that I would rather, you know, light a candle than curse the darkness. And I would rather have a great sense that when you have an eternal perspective, you know, and this is not confetti to the wind optimism, but when you have an eternal perspective and you place that, you know, as the synthesis over what's going on in 21st century culture, I think it gives you, you know, a divine perspective that God himself will never be outmaneuvered, that God is in the details, and that despite the difficulties of the country and the culture, you know, the civilization that we're in, that he is sovereign. And firmly in control and that things unfold in a way that is not outside of the divine radar scope. That's what I believe.
We are obviously in the midst of in a lot of ways, historically unprecedented presidential campaign for a number of reasons. But would you talk a bit about some of the issues in the presidential campaign that, by and large, are not getting the attention that you think they deserve?
Well, I'm really pleased to be asked that question. And to take one step back, I want to echo exactly what you've said. You know, if you and I, Todd, live to be 1,000 years old, we will always conclude that 2016 is a year unlike any other year. I mean, you know, to your first question, all of us get up in the morning and we say, my gosh, it's another day of the train wreck. You know, I believe very strongly that the number one domestic issue in the public square, and this is whether you are a Democrat or a Republican, a liberal or a conservative, I believe the number one issue in 21st century America is religious liberty and the rights of conscience. You know, there's a reason that religious liberty is our first freedom. There's a reason that that amendment is first and not, you know, 21st. It's because it's that central to our way of life. And I would say that the obverse side of the coin is the following, that if we are not religiously free and if our consciences are not unbound, you know, not because it's guaranteed or given by government, but because, this is a gift of providence that is secured in the Constitution. You know, that if our religious liberty and rights of conscience are not secure, then it seems to me, Todd, that every other one of our liberties is insecure. And so, you know, whether it's Donald Trump or Bernard Sanders, whether it's Hillary Clinton or somebody else, potential third-party candidate, which I think is likely, I think that that we're hearing a lot about immigration. We're hearing a lot about ISIS and global terrorism, and rightly we should. But I really believe that the number one issue is religious liberty, the rights of conscience, and frankly, at the end of the day, the United States Supreme Court. You know, we have the empty Justice Scalia seat. In fact, as I'm doing this interview, I'm looking at Justice Scalia's former office at the Supreme Court here in Washington, and I'm reminded every day, you know, what a gigantic loss it was when he died in February. So I think that the Supreme Court and the issues that flow from there, but above all, religious liberty, you know, human life, marriage, you know, all of these questions. But the center of it seems to me, Todd, is religious liberty and conscience.
Tim Gagline is our guest. We're getting a Washington update. He mentions the Supreme Court. When we come back, we'll talk about two Supreme Court cases, one that we're awaiting and the other we're waiting for a result. We'll be right back. What would you say if someone asked you to explain the Trinity? Would you begin with Scripture, the creeds, or some clever analogy? And how are Christ and the gospel at the center of this fundamental Christian teaching? Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Carl Beckwith has written a new book in the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatic series. It's titled The Holy Trinity. You can save $5 by pre-ordering The Holy Trinity at logia.org, logia.org.
Deaconesses are women trained to share the gospel of Jesus Christ through works of mercy, spiritual care, and teaching of the Christian faith. The word deaconess means servant. Find out more on how you can serve in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod through the vocation of deaconess at lcms.org/deaconess. Working in faith, laboring in love, remaining steadfast in the hope of our Lord Jesus Christ. LCMS Deaconess Ministry. lcms.org/deaconess.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Our school is committed to authentic Lutheranism, the entire Book of Concord, and indeed to authentic Lutheranism as it has continued to be confessed and practiced through the centuries right up into our own time.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie, chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
We're committed then to biblical, confessional Christianity and Lutheranism and applying it to the world of today in as effective a way as we can.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu, ctsfw.edu, or call 1-800-481-2155, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. That's the Scholar Cantorum of St. Peter's in the Loop with the hymn Lord of All Hopefulness. It's playing right now at our 24/7 sacred music station, Lutheran Public Radio. This is a radio station that plays exactly what it says, 24/7 sacred music for the world following the course of the church year. You can listen anytime, day or night, for free at LutheranPublicRadio.org and on the LPR mobile app, Lutheran Public Radio, sacred music for the world. We're getting our Washington update. Tim Gagline is our guest. Tim, before the break, you mentioned the Supreme Court. We have two Supreme Court cases that we're awaiting, one of which will be argued in the fall. That actually involves a Lutheran preschool. And then there's one that's already been argued. We're waiting for a decision on it. It's that Texas abortion case. Bring us up to date on both of these.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. You know, the Supreme Court always divides its year, its season, into two halves, and it's and the middle part is the summer. So all those cases that are issued in the early part of the year, we tend to get the decision on those cases typically before the third week of June. Then the Supreme Court goes away for July and August, September, and they come back after that first week in October. And along with the Little Sisters of the Poor case, of which we've already received the decision, we are waiting for the so-called Texas abortion case. This is a massively important case, and perhaps the most important one since the Supreme Court nearly overturned Roe versus Wade in the early 1990s in the so-called Casey decision. And in this case, Todd, of the Texas abortion case, what you essentially have, and I want to make sure that I synthesize this in a way that is really easily digestible. What you have in this case is a test, and the test is: do states have a right at any level to close abortion clinics because those clinics are not providing a particular standard of hygiene and legality in the states? Now, the pro-abortion movement has invested an enormous amount of time and money saying that no state has this authority, that by the lights of the 1973 Roe against Wade decision, the infamous abortion up to and including all 9 months of pregnancy case, that essentially the abortion case has been so federalized that states do not have any ability, even incrementally, to intervene. And of course, the pro-life movement has made enormous strides by saying, in fact, yes, we do, that incrementally states, in fact, can say this is a statute that we in our state have passed, our governor has signed it, it is constitutional, and in fact, states do have this authority. So my view, Todd, is the following. With Justice Scalia no longer on the court and with a 4-4 decision possible, I think that it turns on Justice Kennedy. In pro-life cases, Justice Kennedy has been reliably unreliable. And so I think that for those who are hoping at most for a 4-4 decision, I'm an optimist by nature, sometimes an irredeemable optimist. But because of the unreliability of Justice Kennedy in the past, although I'd like to say to you, you know, it might be a 4-4 decision because we know we have four reliable pro-abortion votes on the Supreme Court, and we know that we have a reliable three pro-life cases on the Supreme Court. But it just seems to me that it is quite possible, and I pray it's not, that it'll be a 5-3 decision against life. And if that is the case, it means that the pro-life movement will find other ways rooted in the ambiguity of parts of Roe against Wade to, you know, take another, chance to bring it to the Supreme Court. So our prayers are fully for the Texas case. And then very briefly, we have a Lutheran religious liberty case, which is coming here to the Supreme Court in Washington just in October. And in this case, we will test the question of whether a Lutheran preschool can receive chopped up tires and rubber for part of its playground. Now, this seems absolutely irrational to most people, but of course, those who are in opposition to religious liberty are very clear. They say that if it is a state-funded program that shreds these tires and provides this kind of playground material to a church-based preschool, that somehow that is unconstitutional. I think it's irrational and even illogical on its face, but we're going to find out in October, in this semi-important religious liberty case, what the limits of the state are and what they're not. So abortion before June in the Supreme Court, religious liberty in October, and we will, of course, have the decision in both cases before the presidential election.
You have touched upon this, Tim, several times here in our conversation already, but kind of summarize it for us. What do you think the impact of Scalia's death has been on the court?
I believe that the late Antonin Scalia, was the most consequential Supreme Court justice in the last 50 years. I think it is virtually impossible to underestimate how absolutely foundational and central Scalia was and will be. In fact, his impact, his legacy on constitutional law was and is so gigantic, Todd, that we will still be internalizing many of his most important decisions for the next 100 years on the court, because the idea of precedent in the decision of cases is so foundational in the way that the Supreme Court rules. And, you know, there are a number of people of very goodwill who say that nobody is perfect, and we certainly as Christians know that other than Jesus Christ, you know, there has been no perfect man. Justice Scalia was by no means perfect, and there are some very important cases in his legacy, namely a Smith religious liberty case, that in my view and in the view of others who track the court, watch the court, believe that it was an unfortunate religious liberty decision. I have absolutely no proof, but I think it's possible that perhaps people close to Justice Scalia came to see that as well. But I would just urge that your many listeners consider reading the dissent that Justice Scalia wrote in the Obergefell decision, which was the decision which redefined a marriage and created a new definition of marriage, allowing people of the same sex to marry. And he wrote in that decision these extremely powerful words in which he said that the biggest issue in this case was not necessarily the redefinition of marriage, so, though he makes it very clear that is a tectonic, gigantic issue, nor homosexuality. Both marriage and homosexuality, needless to say, in the Obergefell decision, are very big topics in the late Justice Scalia's dissent. But Todd, in this brilliant, brilliant dissent, he says that the most important liberty, which is the liberty of self-government, the very sustaining liberty that animates the exceptional nature of America. In fact, on the back of the Supreme Court, up in the pediment, there is a beautiful, beautiful statement, Justice, the guardian of liberty. In this dissent, Justice Scalia says, nobody in our founding, nobody who was part of the architecture of the Constitution would have ever conceived it was possible that on a question as central as what is marriage would ever be defined and then imposed on the country by five unelected lawyers. And he said that this is a form of judicial tyranny, a usurpation of self-government. Well, I think Justice Scalia was not only right, but to your question, it goes to the foundational nature of his importance. And I think that there are so many other issues on marriage, on life, on religious liberty, the bevy of issues that we as Lutheran Christians and Christians in general care about, that Justice Scalia should rightly be remembered as one of the greatest men ever to sit on the Supreme Court.
Tim Gagline is our guest. We're getting our Washington update on this Thursday afternoon, May the 26th. When we come back, we'll talk about the nomination of Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court. And we'll also talk a little bit about, with so much attention on the presidential race, there are other issues that have kind of gotten lost in the dust. Tim Gagline is vice president for external relations for Focus on the Family, formerly served as a special assistant to President George W. Bush and as a deputy director of the White House Office of Public Liaison. Stay tuned.
Your lifeline to the Lutheran worldview. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and lay people worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy promotes confessional Lutheran theology through conferences, scholarly exchanges, and publications like Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatic Series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up for their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com. lutheracademy.com.
Hello, this is Pastor Kevin Golden of Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, Missouri. The saints at Village Lutheran are proud to be part of the Issues Etc. 300, sharing in their Christ-centered, cross-focused proclamation of the gospel. If you find yourself in St. Louis, join us on Sundays at 8:15 and 10:45 for the Divine Service, 9:30 for Bible study and Sunday school, as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation. Or visit us on the web at www.villagelutheranchurch.org.
We have 7 Arabic language transcripts of Issues Etc. that you can download for free.
يمكنك تنزيل النص لسبع حلقات من برنامج قضايا باللغة العربية مجانا.
These broadcast transcripts cover the 6 chief parts of Luther's Small Catechism and include a teaching on why do bad things happen.
تغطي تلك النصوص الأجزاء الستة الرئيسية من كتاب التعليم المسيحي لمارتن لوثر.
You can download and print these Arabic transcripts for free. Just go to issuesetc.org, click publications.
وتشمل تعليما عن لماذا تحدث المصائب؟ لتنزيل وطباعة النصوص العربية مجانا، اذهب إلى issuesetc.org ثم انقر على publications.
Casting Christ's net on the internet, issuesetc.org.
نطرح شبكة المسيح على شبكة الإنترنت. issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Thursday afternoon, May the 26th, we're getting our Washington update with Tim Gagline. We're going to spend some time talking with him about the nomination of Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court. And then Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer will join us. Our series, Christ in the Old Testament, continues. We'll be in 1 Kings 8, where the Ark of the Covenant is brought into the temple. Solomon blesses the Lord, and Solomon prays the prayer of dedication for the temple. We'll find Christ in all of those elements of the Old Testament story in 1 Kings 8 with Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer in about 20 minutes here on Issues Etc. Tim, let's talk a little bit about the nomination of Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, this is a very important precedent, I fear, which is that, you know, with less than a year to go in a presidency, President Obama chose to nominate to the Supreme Court a 63-year-old, very liberal, current federal judge who sits as the chief judge on the D.C., which is Washington, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. By every light, everyone who knows him, a conservative and liberal, Democrat and Republican, think he's a really fine guy. They think he's an able jurist, and they believe that he has you know, a remarkable resume. But the question is, with less than a year to go in a presidency and looking at fulfilling this very large seat of the late Justice Scalia, the question is, what does the Constitution say about this? And very frankly, the Constitution says that the president has the power to nominate, but, and this is so important, the United States Senate has the authority of advise and consent. Well, what does advise and consent mean? Historically, it has meant that you have hearings and that you have a vote. But it also means something else. And I think this is so central to the history of the Supreme Court, because it not only means that you have a hearing and a vote, advise and consent also means that the party in control of the U.S. Senate determines the timeline of when there will be a hearing or no hearing and whether there will be a vote or no vote. And the Republicans are the majority in the Senate. Justice Scalia, needless to say, a great constitutional a conservative, a constitutionalist, they have said, we do not want President Obama, you know, to have that kind of an you know, ability to nominate and then have confirmed, you know, a liberal to the Scalia seat. And so my own sense is that Merrick Garland, that nomination is going nowhere. And the largest historical question is, if Hillary Clinton is elected to the presidency, the question is, would she renominate Merrick Garland? Or, knowing potentially that the Republicans could lose the Senate and that Hillary Clinton could be elected president, it's possible that the Republicans who control the Senate currently would say, you know, we're not going to get any better than this, and we could do a whole lot worse. Maybe we'll go into a lame duck session before the inauguration and vote to confirm him anyway. So I think the jury is out until the election. But as of now, my strong sense, Todd, is that this nomination is going nowhere, and that probably until the end of this calendar year, the Supreme Court will remain 4-4 with the Scalia seat remaining open.
What do you say to people who have observed that Republican presidents gave us Justice Anthony Kennedy, that you spoke of earlier, and retired Justice David Souter? So it really doesn't make much difference who occupies the Oval Office. What do you say to that, Tim?
Well, I would say two things. The first is, I think it very much matters who occupies the Oval Office, because for all of the great disappointments, and you mentioned them, and there are many others, that there are also great successes. Justice Scalia, who we've been talking about, Justice Alito, who we've been talking about, the late, great Chief Justice of the United States, William Rehnquist. I mean, these are really toweringly important figures for those of us who are Christians and the issues that we care about most that come before the Supreme Court. But the second thing I'd say, Todd, at the exact same time, is what an extraordinary number of disappointments we have had, not under Democratic presidents, we've certainly had lots of those, but under Republican presidents. You mentioned Justice Kennedy, Justice Souter, Justice O'Connor, the author of Roe versus Wade, Justice Blackmun, was a Republican appointee. You know, just the former Chief Justice Warren Burger, a Republican appointee, often voted wrong on major issues. I'm reminded of the quip that President Eisenhower made after his presidency. He was asked, President Eisenhower, do you have any regrets regarding your presidency? He said, I do. He said, and they're both sitting on the Supreme Court. And he was referring, of course, to the Chief Justice Earl Warren, who was a calamitous for the issues that we believe in, a real radical. And also William Brennan, also equally disagreeable on the issues we care about, and a man also, Brennan, who turned out to be actually a very famous constitutional scholar on the left. So, yes, the precedent is absolutely there for Republican presidents who make terrible decisions, but may I say there also is a precedent where Republican presidents make excellent decisions. And unfortunately, those are the choices that so many of us live with when we think about the history of this court and we think about, you know, what was actually happened over time for all the issues that we care about so very, very deeply.
I think we can safely assume the kind of justices that a President Hillary Clinton would be attempting to populate the court with. What are your thoughts on the kind of justices that a President Donald Trump would populate the court with?
Well, two things. I totally agree with you on Hillary Clinton. She, in my view, already knows who she would likely nominate. This has been an obsession of the left in Washington and far beyond. And I feel quite confident in saying that if she is elected and that if she has a Senate that does not have veto-proof majority, I feel very strongly we will get very radical judges on the Supreme Court and in all the federal courts during a potential Hillary Clinton legacy. I have to say there is one remarkable note of optimism, and the remarkable note of optimism is that candidates of both parties rarely in American history have released a list of potential Supreme Court nominations. Now, it doesn't pledge them to keeping their promise, but I must say that I was incredibly pleasantly surprised by the issue, by the list that Donald Trump released of his potential Supreme Court nominees if elected. He actually named 11 people. I know several of those people to be outstanding constitutional conservatives. And not to say that Donald Trump will keep his promise or pledge, but if he were to keep his promise or pledge, if he were elected, I think that most reasonable constitutional conservatives would conclude that it's a rather outstanding, even luminous list.
Let's talk a little bit about, since there is so much attention on the presidential race, other major races that have kind of gotten lost in the dust up. What's worth watching?
You know, I'm really glad you asked this, Todd, because the country has been almost obsessed on the 2016 run for the White House. But a lot of us are paying attention to two things. We're paying attention to the United States Senate, where the Republicans have a lot at stake. Although they currently are the majority, they don't have a veto-proof majority, and they have 24 seats up for re-election. That is absolutely huge. The Democrats, they only have 10 seats. And of the 24 Republican seats, at least 6 and maybe 7 are highly vulnerable. And that means that the current majority, the current Republican majority in the Senate, could in fact shift to the Democrats. So I think that when you have potentially Donald Trump at the top of the ticket, you have this very uneven, asymmetrical year that we've been in, where nobody knows what's going to happen day to day in the presidential election, much less everything else. I think we have to assume that down ballot, a Trump candidacy among the Republicans and a Clinton candidacy among the Democrats potentially could have a very huge impact on the final composition of the United States Senate. The other thing I think worth watching is the United States House of Representatives. There are many vulnerable Republicans, and there are a handful of vulnerable Democrats. And that's a fancy way of saying that although the Republican Party currently heavily dominates the House of Representatives, I think looking at it district by district, that it is quite possible that while the Republicans will continue to be the majority party there, I think it is, in fact, quite possible that their majority will be heavily reduced because, going back to where we began the interview, there are many conservatives, there are many even party regulars who have been somewhat disappointed, maybe even disillusioned with the Republican leadership in the House and the Senate. So I think that this is a very difficult year to look at the White House race, to look at the Senate, to look at the House. It's very difficult to look and say, I feel semi-confident that this or that will happen. I think that that's just not in the cards in 2016.
This is all part, of course, of kind of a general anti-establishment mood in the country that is represented most sharply by the supporters of Bernie Sanders and of Donald Trump. How does that anti-establishment mood read in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, I think it reads deeply, widely, and with great length. I think that you have to conclude that by any stretch of the imagination, this is a country among many people who are enraged at Washington and at Wall Street. They feel almost rebellious, and they know, left and right, that quite apart from politics, that we are going through and experiencing a moral and a social revolution. And when you combine rage, rebellion, and revolution, you apply that to Wall Street and to Washington, D.C., I think that the outcome, as we've been talking about, becomes very, very difficult for people who try to run by saying, I have lots and lots of experience in Washington, D.C. I mean, that makes them immediately suspect. But I think it's also true of all the institutions, because I think a lot of people have concluded that what we need in America is not more legislation. We don't need more stocks and more bonds. I think a lot of people have said, you know, this is not Hollywood's country. It's not Washington, D.C.'s country. It's not the country of the universities. It's our country. And I think people are working very hard, even those who are disillusioned, to say, I'm concerned about losing my country. I'm concerned about losing the Constitution. You know, although I have imperfect choices, I want to make a choice that I need to make to right the ship, as it were. And I think that that's where we're at.
Tim Gagelein is Vice President for External Relations for Focus on the Family. He formerly served as a special assistant to President George W. Bush and as a deputy director of the White House Office for Public Liaison. He's author of the book, The Man in the Middle, an inside account of faith and politics in the George W. Bush era. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Tim, thank you very much.
A real pleasure, Todd. Be of good cheer.
When we come back, it's time for Christ in the Old Testament. We'll delve into the mystery of the incarnation in 1 Kings 8, the dedication of the temple. How is confessional Lutheranism similar to and different from American evangelicalism, Roman Catholicism, and Eastern Orthodoxy? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May is titled Being Lutheran. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 800-325-3040. Save $2 by ordering Being Lutheran during the month of May. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month, Being Lutheran.
Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, engages young adults in a Christ-centered environment, delivering academic excellence and spiritual growth to develop Christian leaders for tomorrow. We provide a Christ-focused alternative to public high schools. Many of our students receive tuition assistance. To help us provide tuition assistance to more students, go to melhs.org and click on the giving page, or call me, Dr. J. Krause, principal, at 618-656-0043.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
He's the most Lutheran man in the world.
I'm not always in Pensacola, Florida, but when I am, I attend Emmanuel Lutheran Church.
Congregation of Emmanuel Lutheran Church of Pensacola, Florida invites you to join us for divine services on Sundays at 8 or 10:30, Sunday school and Bible class at 9:15. Whether you're in Pensacola to enjoy the white sandy beaches of the Emerald Coast or for military training, we invite you to join us. Jesus is here. Word, water, bread and wine for you.
Emmanuel, God with us.
Stay Lutheran, my friends.
In my family, education means cultivating wisdom and virtue by teaching what is good, true, and beautiful. Memoria Press makes this type of education possible with their classical Christian curriculum. Characterized by simplicity, quality, and affordability, Memoria Press gives my children a rich classical education. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.